We begin our second hour of Making Waves with an interview of Ann Miller about her upcoming trip to Palestine.
This is Steve Diamond with Making Waves. I'm speaking with Ann Miller, director of New Hampshire Peace Action, who is about to go to Palestine this Saturday, I understand. Is it this Saturday?
It is. I'm leaving on the 24th.
Okay. So just as a little bit of background on the issue, when did you first become aware that there are such things as Palestinians and Israelis, and when did you decide that it's a conflict you wanted to take action about?
Well, in terms of your first question about when did I become aware that there are Palestinians and Israelis, that's been for quite some time. In the media, as I was growing up, obviously, I believe I supported the Israeli position, I think, just because that was what was always on the media. And in terms of my work through New Hampshire Peace Action, we're an anti-war nuclear disarmament organization that's currently focused, most of our focus is on stopping the war in Iraq and building public sentiment and educational outreach about the war in Iraq. However, we do have a working group called the Palestine Education Network, and I've been involved with that group as well. And when the opportunity presented itself for me to go to Palestine and to Israel, I said, I would absolutely like to know more about what's happening there, both from the Palestinian perspective as well as from the Israeli perspective, because I believe both perspectives are really important and need to be fully understood before we can even think about what possible solutions might be.
I know you've also just come back from Saudi Arabia and Iran. Are you trying to get sort of a broad perspective of the region?
I think so. I mean, I think that's the way it's turning out. I was in Iran a year ago and then in Saudi Arabia last September, and obviously those are two very different countries from Israel and from Palestine, and very different from one another. And I think as much as anything, I'm learning about the complexity of the Middle East and the diversity of the Middle East as opposed to the uniformity of the Middle East. Because every country is discrete and is different, has different populations, different histories, different ethnicities, and different religions as well. So it's all incredibly interesting to be thinking about and putting together.
But they do seem to have some solidarity with each other. They're all generally Muslim countries, and I think most Americans see them as sort of one sort of broad nationality.
I mean, I think that's we see it in this country, and I'm always interested on how few people actually even know the difference between Iraq and Iran, and they're two incredibly different countries. And although most countries in the Middle East are Muslim, although not exclusively, even when you start talking about Islam or Muslim countries, there's diversity under that category as well, whether you're Sunni Muslim or a Shia Muslim or a Sunni Wahhabi Muslim, which is the case in many parts of Saudi Arabia. And so there are other Baha'i Muslims as well. And there are Christians, there are many Arab Christians as well, so not to mention the Kurds, obviously, in Turkey and in Iraq. So there are just a multiplicity of differences. And then even within that, there's even more complexity. I mean, just like in this country, when you try to characterize the American people in one way, I mean, we sort of can easily see how that doesn't make any sense and isn't useful in describing, I think, our national character. I mean, even when you're talking about Israel and Palestine, we tend to see it in this black and white Israel and Palestine, but even within Israel and even within Palestine, there's a whole continuum of belief and opinion and willingness to act or not act. So I think it's also important to remember that.
I recently learned there are a large section of Judaism that believes Zionism is a bad idea. You said that when you were growing up, perhaps you favored the Israeli position on the issue, on most issues. What was there a specific moment that changed your mind about that, or just a slow evolution of your ideas about it?
I mean, I think that as you learn more about the conflict and you read from a diversity of sources, I've been reading from a lot from a website called bitterlemons.org, which actually gives equal time and access to a Palestinian perspective and an Israeli perspective, and diversity within both of those perspectives. And I think that's really helped me see the situation in a more comprehensive way. But I think general education in general has helped me move along, and as I've looked at for alternative media as opposed to mainstream media, which is what I was raised on as a child. I mean, there just simply wasn't a lot of alternative media out there, and not in the particular household in which I grew up.
In your reading, what do you believe the source of, or the root of, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is?
It's a difficult, and I think it's a difficult question. I mean, I think in part the root might be the fact that Palestinians and Israelis have different views of world history and their place within world history. I think that's part of it. I think part of it has to do with colonialism, Western colonialism, and the effect that that's had in the Middle East in general, and in Israel and Palestine in particular. I mean, there's a long historical legacy. I mean, Zionism found its roots in the early 19th century, and there have been Jews living in Palestine since the beginning of the 19th century. So this has spanned, you know, almost 200 years. You've had a Jewish presence in Israel and in Palestine, and there's a biblical, obviously a biblical allegiance for the Jews to that land. Palestinians have lived there for centuries, so obviously Arabs also feel they have a claim to that land. And so that creates, obviously, conflict and tension, and sort of the story has gone on from there, from those roots.
As I understand it, though, the actual violence between Israelis and Palestinians has been pretty much since the British Mandate in 1948. Is that correct?
There was actually, interestingly, in the early 1920s and even a few years prior to that is when the first violence and the violent clashes started between Israel and Palestine. I thought when I first started my investigations really that it was the Holocaust resulted in the establishment of Israel, but that's not the case. I mean, this whole Zionist effort's been happening, I mean, it started happening over 100 years prior to that. And again, at this point, it's been over 200 years that you've had Jewish families living in that region. Mm. Yeah, it's really interesting. Again, because I thought it was 1948 where things really got started until... But that's not the case at all.
What are the Palestinians and Israelis fighting over? Is it about land? Is it about religion? Is it about something else?
I think at this point, to a large extent, it's about land and it's about water. And it's about human rights. Our tax dollars, billions of U.S. tax dollars, are being spent in Israel building walls to separate Palestinians from Israelis and Palestinians from other Palestinians and Palestinians from sources of food, agricultural land, and water. And so what are Israelis fighting over? I'd say at this point, many Israelis believe they're fighting over security. I think Palestinians at this point are fighting for sovereignty and their human rights. And I would also say the right of return for the millions of refugees who have been displaced.
Politicians talk about a roadmap to peace. What course forward would you suggest that might bring about a just peace?
Well, I think you should ask me that question when I return on April 8th, and I'm sure I'll have a more comprehensive answer. But I would say at this point, whatever just peace is decided on, it has to have something to do with human rights of Palestinians and giving Palestinians human rights, water access, agricultural access, and sovereignty, which is not something that Palestinians have had. And I may feel differently about this or think differently about this in 3 weeks, but I also argue that Israel also needs to move back to its 67 borders and stop building the wall.
By sovereignty, do you mean a state?
I do.
What role does the U.S. government play in the conflict, and how might it be improved?
That's an excellent question. Israel is the number one recipient of aid from the United States that measures in billions of dollars per year of taxpayer dollars. Again, it's U.S. dollars that have been helping to build the highways through the West Bank and build the walls that are separating Palestinians from their families and separating Palestinians from Israelis and cutting. And I don't know how much the audience knows about what's happening in the West Bank, but currently Palestinians are not allowed on these highways that cut right up through the West Bank. There are roadblocks that people have to stand at for hours, 10, 12 hours. Women who are delivering children because they on the side of the road because they can't get through roadblocks. These kinds of things. These are the kinds of things that are taking away from the dignity of Palestinians. And how can you live under those conditions? It's an occupation. And there's currently an occupation of Palestine, and we need to acknowledge that fact. The U.S., I believe, could help facilitate an answer to this conflict if it had the political will to do so, because we have the power to withhold funding from Israel if we chose to do so. I know President Bush did that in a number of different, first President Bush in the early 1990s did that. I can't remember what the issue was exactly, but it's been threatened or suggested before. It's not to say that we couldn't do it again.
What influence have international peace activists had in the area?
Well, last week we, I guess you would say, celebrated Rachel Corrie Day, which was last Thursday, I believe, March 16th. Rachel Corrie was an international solidarity movement worker who was killed in Gaza in 2003, just before the beginning of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. I think her story has had a major impact in getting information out to the U.S. communities about what's happening in Gaza, what's happening in the West Bank. Her parents have become strident voices for peace. Their grounding is in this belief in human rights, and it's very compelling. And a number of other activists as well. I mean, you've got many Jewish activists who are working in Palestine to ameliorate the situation in Palestine, as well as other groups and activists.
So international activists are providing direct aid to the Palestinians and also getting the word out to the rest of the world about the situation and how they might improve it.
Yes, and I think getting the word out to American citizens is probably the most important and useful thing that we can be doing at this point.
How exactly have the peace activists helped the Palestinians? Like you said, the Israeli peace activists have gone to the Palestinian areas to help. What exactly have they been doing?
Well, a number I know have been living with Palestinian families, working on Palestinian land, helping to plant olive trees. I think also another thing that we can do and do more of is buy Palestinian products. The Palestinian economy is completely tied into that of Israel. In fact, 80% is tied into Israel. And I think anything that we can do to help support the Palestinian economy would be a really positive thing.
Since the Hamas election, I understand the Israeli government is withholding the taxes that it collects on behalf of the Palestinians. Do you have any more information about that? I suppose that would aggravate the situation more.
Yes, I believe it will. And also, I don't know if the U.S. has done it yet, but they've also threatened to cut off funding. I would preface, or at least say parenthetically, that the funding that the U.S. gives to Palestinians is nothing compared to the billions of dollars of aid that it gives to Israel. So I think that would sort of be the first thing. And it's my understanding that Iran is going to be picking up some of that slack, and that other Arab countries, including Saudi Arabia, are refusing to cut off aid to Palestinians, which I think is a good thing. I think we should see how Hamas does. I think we need to give the situation some time and then reevaluate the situation. Although I would say that cutting off aid is not the solution.
How exactly should we view the new Hamas government? And ideally, what positive role will they play to improve the situation?
I think it's going to be really interesting. And I don't know the answer to that question yet. I think that time is going to tell. This is the first time that Hamas has had sort of legitimate political power in Palestine. It's going to be interesting to see whether they're able to use it well, whether they're able to exert any kind of positive leadership. I mean, we know that Hamas, in addition to terrorist activities, also gives a lot back to communities. I mean, that I think that's one of the reasons why Hamas was able to secure so many seats, is that they help fund schools. I mean, they help people get where they need to go. They provide infrastructure and support and that kind of thing. And we can't forget those essential human needs and infrastructures that make societies run. So it'll be interesting to see. I don't know. History's guess.
What are your goals for this trip, and who are you going with?
I'm going with FOR, which is the Fellowship of Reconciliation. They're an interfaith group that takes journeys to different places in the world to explore situations of peace and situations of war and possibilities for reconciliation. We're going to be staying mostly in the West Bank, although we are going to be traveling around Israel. We'll be staying with Israeli families and Palestinian families and in talking about possibilities for nonviolent conflict resolution in the area and what a real roadmap to peace might look like. I'm also interested in exploring what Israelis think about the possibilities of a nuclear-free Middle East zone. I don't know if you remember, but one of the UN resolutions that ended the first Gulf War was a resolution that called for a weapons of mass destruction free Middle East. And Israel, although it's undeclared, has a nuclear arsenal somewhere in the vicinity of 200 to 300 nuclear weapons. And I'm just interested in how Israelis, ordinary Israelis, view their security situation, whether they feel more or less secure having a nuclear arsenal. And then also the possibilities for disarmament and whether or not some sort of multilateral agreement around disarmament might help soften the situation that's happening currently with Iran and the standoff over their nuclear programs.
Interesting. I know that the Vatican and American public opinion wants the abolition of all nuclear weapons. It'd be interesting to see if the Israeli population feels similarly.
Yeah, I mean, it will be interesting. It's interesting because also in terms of nuclear power, they have a lot of nuclear power plants, it's my understanding, that are ready to be decommissioned. Israel is a tiny, tiny place as well. And so, with threats from other places, it'd be interesting to see whether people think they're more or less secure. I'm also hoping to get an interview with Mordecai Vanunu, who was a whistleblower decades ago about Israel's nuclear program.
Is Mordecai Vanunu still in jail at all?
No, he's currently out of jail. He's living in Jerusalem in a hotel. He's not allowed to leave Israel, is my understanding. And there's some sort of trial process that's happening. But it is my understanding that he's not actually in prison at this time.
Israel has made some statements that suggest they might do a preemptive strike against Iranian nuclear sites, even if the United States doesn't. What likelihood do you foresee of that?
Yeah, there's quite a bit of that in the press last year, last November and December of 2005. I have not heard any statements to that effect since Sharon had his stroke. And so I don't know. The time that was being bandied about last year, late last year, was March 2006, the end of March 2006, which would interestingly, hopefully not ironically, correspond with the delegation to Palestine and to Israel. But, you know, in terms of whether they actually will do it, I think is anybody's guess. I'm not sure anybody knows.
So you said you were going to the West Bank and into Israel. Do you have any more details on where you're planning to go and what you're planning to do while there?
Well, we'll also be traveling to Tel Aviv, so we'll be in the West as well and all over the West Bank, spending quite a bit of time in Jerusalem. It's a small country, so I anticipate that we'll be able to cover quite a bit of it. And I'm just interested in learning more. I think firsthand experience is always a good thing, and a firsthand perspective is always a good thing, especially in today's media climate where everything seems to be biased either for or against or this way or that. And I'd just like to see it with my own eyes and come back with my own stories to share with folks in New Hampshire.
Your slideshow's got some rave reviews. Are you planning to take pictures again?
I will be. I think it's important for Americans to understand what the meaning of the wall actually is and the grand disparities between how Israeli settlers are living in the West Bank, say, and how Palestinians are living. And I think when we see pictures, it just, you know, it speaks so much more candidly about situations than words. And I think it also, through pictures, you can meet people in a way that you can't always meet people when you talk about them.
And how long will you be in Palestine, Israel?
I'll be there for 2 weeks.
That might be enough time to get through those checkpoints and everything. Has your work for Justice for Palestinians led to accusations of anti-Semitism?
To some extent, yes. We are trying to publish one newsletter article each quarter that has something to do with the Israeli-Palestinian crisis. And every time a newsletter goes out, we do typically lose a member or two who think that we are too biased in the Palestinian perspective. I personally have been accused of bias, but not of anti-Semitism, although I know many of my colleagues with the Palestinian Education Network have been accused of anti-Semitism many times.
How do you usually respond to that?
That it's not a question of being anti-Semitic. I think it's a question of upholding human rights that are being abridged every day in Palestine, in the occupied territories of Palestine.
What else is New Hampshire Peace Action or other statewide groups doing around issues of Palestine?
Well, it's my understanding that the real group working specifically on the Palestinian-Israeli issue is the Palestine Education Network, this working group that sprung from a reading group that took place in the spring of 2005, and they're bringing folks from any different number of perspectives. I know Seacoast Peace Response brought a woman named Dr. Alice Rothschild to the area several years ago, I believe, and they're bringing her back up to Peterborough next week. And we have vigils around the Caterpillar dealership because Caterpillar is directly contributing to the occupation because it's Caterpillar machinery that's used to demolish homes in Palestine as well. So some folks are working on that issue. And there's a lot going on in the Boston area that folks from New Hampshire tap into. There's still a tremendous amount of work to be done.
What can listeners do to help?
I think first and foremost, start educating yourselves about both perspectives. I cited a website earlier, bitterlemon.org, which gives a variety of different perspectives on the conflict, and I think that's really important to understand the nature of mistakes on both sides. And until we can fully understand both sides and listen to both sides, I think resolution is going to continue to elude us. And I really probably shouldn't say us. I'm not a direct stakeholder in the conflict. It's the Palestinians and Israeli themselves who are going to be this us.
Ann Miller, Director of New Hampshire Peace Action, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
For today's People's History section, we bring you the LA Sound Posse's series, Radio Truth, with Michael Parenti. This one is on Demons of Imperialism, rhetorical technique of imperialists and colonizers, still used, as in Iraq and Palestine.
This is Radio Truth, a series of commentaries by Dr. Michael Parenti. Michael Parenti is an activist and internationally known award-winning author and scholar. His recent books include The Assassination of Julius Caesar and Super Patriotism. His latest book, The Culture Struggle, will be released in November 2005. For further information, please visit his website, michaelparenti.org.
The Demons of Imperialism. When colonizers go into a country, take it over, steal the land and resources, and slaughter and enslave the people, they justify this by demonizing their victims with racist and dehumanizing terminology. The Puritans called the Indians dangerous wild beasts, brutes, devils, and devil worshippers whose souls were to be consigned to their proper place in hell by a process of extermination. In the Black Hawk War of 1832, in which men, women, and children of the Sayuk tribe were systematically butchered, there was talk of fast getting rid of these demons in human shape, who were more like wild beasts than men. George Washington likened the red savages to wolves, both being beasts of prey, though they differ in shape. Rudyard Kipling referred to the Asian victims of British imperialism as half-devil, half-child. In 1897, Winston Churchill judged Afghans to be dangerous and as sensible as mad dogs, fit to be treated as such, and he recommended the use of poison gas against them. British Prime Minister Lloyd George said his government retained the right to, quote, kill niggers. He was referring to Asians and Africans. Niggers was also the term used by American officials in the Philippines to describe the Filipinos, whom they slaughtered in great numbers. In the meantime, President William McKinley talked about Anglo-Saxon obligation to uplift and civilize inferior peoples, as in the Philippines. The future belongs to the white man, announced Kaiser Wilhelm II in 1908. He meant the white imperialists. Remember, these colonizers come as murderous plunderers, but they see themselves as civilizing saviors. Remember also that these racist pronouncements issued not from some uncultivated, poorly educated, obscure individuals, but from the most eminent members of society, the upper-class gentlemen, the leaders and patricians, the imperialists. To this day, racists still treat the subordinate social status of people of color as a manifestation of their inferior biological and mental capacities rather than as something foisted within the socio-economic system itself. The demonizing myths to justify the displacement and disfranchisement of Palestinians in Palestine were propagated by the Zionist imperialists. Quoting Prime Minister Menachem Begin, for instance, the Palestinians are beasts walking on two legs. Quoting Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir in 1988, the Palestinians should be crushed like grasshoppers, heads smashed against the boulders and walls. Quoting Prime Minister Barak in 2000, the Palestinians are like crocodiles. The more you give them meat, the more they want. The imperial power is also above the law. Israel may have the right to put others on trial, says Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, but certainly no one has the right to put the Jewish people and the State of Israel on trial. Similarly, when the U.S. went and invaded, bombed, and destroyed the infrastructure of Iraq, we got a more polished imperialist rhetoric, and yet we got some of the same kinds of techniques, dehumanizing the leader, saying the leader was a butcher and a demon and a devil, which then gave the U.S. colonizers the right to bomb and kill the people, occupy the country, and destroy its infrastructure and its society while taking over its oil, patronizing the people, designating them as unequipped for self-rule, and hoisting a constitution on them in mimicry of U.S. democracy. The U.S. occupiers in Iraq are no different from other colonizers. They would victimize the people of the country, all in the name of saving them. This is Michael Parenti for Radio Truth.
This commentary was produced by the LA Sound Posse and may be freely copied and distributed. You can find us on the web at lasoundposse.org. The music was Flute Medicine by Synth.
You're listening to Making Waves. Now we bring you Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present journalist and author Robert Dreyfus, who assesses escalating violence in Iraq as the U.S. occupation enters its fourth year. Ned Lamont, a progressive candidate challenging Connecticut U.S. Senator Joseph Lieberman, who discusses his grassroots campaign to oust President Bush's favorite Democrat. And independent energy consultant Joel Gordis, who examines the impact of climate change and destructive weather patterns on the insurance industry. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The International Criminal Court, or the ICC, made its first arrest in charging Thomas Lubanga, rebel leader in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, with war crimes, including recruiting child soldiers for his militia. Lubanga was first arrested a year ago after 9 United Nations peacekeepers from Bangladesh were killed in a firefight with rebel groups in the Ituri district in the war-ravaged northeast Congo. In mid-March, he was handed over to the ICC by the Congolese government in the capital city of Kinshasa. The ICC will try Lobanga in The Hague for enlisting, conscripting, and using children under 15 years of age for his militia, the Union of Congolese Patriots. According to the BBC, teams of ICC investigators were working in the northeast Congo in recent months to investigate the deaths of 50,000 civilians since the civil war in Congo began in 1999. Lubanga's ethnically based militia has battled soldiers from the rival Lendu tribe in Ituri over the region's large deposits of gold. Currently, 17,000 UN peacekeepers are based in the Congo to oversee security for an election set for June. Earlier, the ICC had sought to arrest the leaders of the rebel Lord's Resistance Army in Uganda, but they remain at large. The War Crimes Court is also investigating the violence in Darfur, the western province of Sudan, where acts of genocide have occurred. The ICC is not recognized by the United States due to the Bush administration's concerns that U.S. soldiers could be prosecuted in combat zones. In late May, Al Jazeera International, a new 24-hour English news channel sponsored by the Arabic Satellite News Service, will be launched. Already, Arabic-speaking journalists have expressed their fears that Al Jazeera's aggressive style of covering Middle East politics will be toned down to appeal to Western viewers. Funded by the Emir of Kuwait, Al Jazeera has won the loyal following of 40 million Arabic TV viewers, built on graphic images of the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and coverage of the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories. The new enterprise, Al Jazeera International, will have news bureaus in Doha, Qatar, London, Washington, D.C., and Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. It has recruited some top talent, including David Frost, Dave Marish, formerly a reporter for ABC's Nightline, and Riga Omar, a Somali-born journalist who covers the Iraq War for the BBC. The news channel, according to managing director Nigel Parsons, will have its own bureaus and original programming separate from Al Jazeera. Yet producers for both networks will share video and do joint planning. The target audience are not just Americans frustrated with mainstream U.S. media, but the growing number of Arab-speaking immigrants in Europe and the millions of Asian and African Muslims who do not speak Arabic. Environmentalists are waging an aggressive campaign to oust California Congressman Richard Pombo, chairman of the House of Representatives Resource Committee and author of a bill to vastly weaken the Federal Endangered Species Act. Pombo, an ally of former House Speaker Tom DeLay, is a longtime incumbent in a conservative-leaning rural district who won 60% of the popular vote in the 2004 election. According to The Grist, an online environmental magazine, Pombo could be endangered by ethics allegations that have recently surfaced. He took $35,000 in contributions from indicted lobbyist Jack Abramoff and his Indian clients from 1999 to 2004. In addition, Pombo used his influence with DeLay to help squash an investigation of Texas millionaire Charles Hurwitz, owner of Pacific Lumber and foe of environmentalists. Through his congressional career, Pombo, a former rancher, has taken nearly $225,000 in political contributions from real estate developers. In the last campaign, he received $85,000 in donations from oil and gas interests. Pombo is a major backer of opening up the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil drilling. Already, former GOP Maverick Congressman Pete Maclowski, author of the Endangered Species Act in the early 1970s, is waging a shoestring primary challenge against Pombo. Environmental groups, including the Defenders of Wildlife and the Sierra Club, plan to spend $1 million to defeat Pombo in 2006. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruben Abreu.
On the third anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, President Bush traveled the country and held a press conference to defend his policy and repeat an optimistic forecast about progress being made in the war. But there are numerous facts on the ground that directly contradict the president's rosy assertions. Iraq's former U.S.-installed Prime Minister Iyad Alawi said of the recent intensification of sectarian violence, "We are losing an average 50 to 60 people, if not more, a day throughout the country. If this is not civil war," he said, "then God knows what civil war is." Timed to coincide with the third anniversary of the war, the Pentagon's Operation Swarmer, involving more than 1,500 U.S. and Iraqi troops and 50 aircraft, was billed as the largest military campaign since the start of the conflict. But reporters on the ground say that the operation, which encountered few if any insurgents, was likely little more than a media show. Meanwhile, the House approved an amendment to an emergency spending bill by Representative Barbara Lee, Democrat of California, that would prohibit the use of funds to establish permanent U.S. military bases in Iraq. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with journalist Robert Dreyfus, author of the book Devil's Game: How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam. He assesses the increasing sectarian violence and death squad activity in Iraq as the U.S. occupation enters its fourth year.
Every year since the invasion, things have gotten progressively worse in Iraq, not better. I think it's safe to say that Iraq is now in the early phases of civil war, and I calculate the start of that civil war from the time last summer or last fall, when the number of people killed by death squads, execution, kidnappings, and so forth, mostly by pro-government militias, exceeded the number of people killed by the insurgency. In other words, more people are now being killed in this sectarian warfare through torture, murders, and executions than the resistance is killing. So while the United States is continuing to fight the so-called insurgency, the latest being this massive air offensive that we launch in the area around Samarra, north of Baghdad, Iraq itself is descending into a hell. It's descending into a completely insecure, violence-filled chaos in which there's no security for the people of Iraq. There's no economic reconstruction going on, and each community is arming itself to the teeth in preparation for what looks like the disintegration of the country. So it's hard to overstate how bad things are in Iraq, but in fact, they could continue to get significantly worse.
Robert Dreyfus, wanted to ask you a bit about the death squad activity. I don't know what you have in terms of information on the U.S. connection to these death squads, but can you give us any details as to what is happening there on the ground?
Well, I've been writing about this for a couple of years now. I would say that at the beginning, back when we had the interim government in place and we were creating the beginnings of an Iraqi security force, the CIA and the Pentagon did help to create these so-called wolf brigades and other units within the Interior Ministry, kind of police commando units, that began on a small scale to engage in death squad type activity. And I think we turned a blind eye to it because we were so obsessed with combating the insurgency. I have to say that now I think it's gotten completely out of hand. The United States isn't behind it anymore because we're really not behind much in Iraq. The Shiite religious parties that control the government and are not especially friendly to the United States have chosen to vastly expand this death squad activity on their own initiative, probably also with the help of Iran and the Iranian intelligence services. And that activity has actually been, I think, shocking to Ambassador Khalilzad and to some of the military who've tried to clamp down on some of its worst abuses. You'll remember last fall the military uncovered a torture prison where several hundred Sunnis, mostly Sunnis, had been held illegally and were being tortured, and in fact tortured to death in some cases. The military, the U.S. military, has also on at least one or two occasions arrested red-handed some of these death squad folks and locked them up. But the situation has gotten so far out of control now, with so many different players in the game, with so many different militias operating and paramilitary forces operating throughout the country, that Baghdad is starting to resemble Beirut during the Lebanese Civil War of the 1970s and 80s. I think it's far beyond the point where it can be said to be under any kind of American control.
As we get closer to the important November midterm congressional elections, what do you think the Bush administration's game plan is in terms of withdrawing troops, even if it's symbolic or a way to stem their losses in the election?
Oh, I don't think they have a game plan. I think they're completely adrift. I mean, their last hope was the December elections, when Iraq went to the polls to elect what was supposed to be a permanent government. The parliament has only met for, I think, half an hour in that entire 3.5 months. They don't have a prime minister. They don't have a cabinet. They don't have anything like a government. So the whole intention of the Bush administration was to allow that December election to create some veneer of stability so that we could start pulling enough troops out to make it look good. Now, however, they're talking about sending additional forces back in, which means that come the elections in November, I think the glaring failure of Iraq is going to be, you know, smack dab in the middle of the television sets for everybody to see. So they don't have any game plan. I mean, I think they're hoping that by some miracle that Iraq will somehow stabilize itself. But with each passing day, that looks less and less likely.
That was investigative journalist Robert Dreyfus, author of the book Devil's Game: How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam. Read his articles online at www.robertdreyfus.com. As Connecticut's junior U.S. Senator Joseph Lieberman runs to win another 6 years in office, the image of the kiss he received from President Bush just after the 2005 State of the Union address burns in the memory of many of the state's progressive voters. Lieberman's strong support for the president's war in Iraq has, for several years, sparked anger and talk of mounting a challenge to the three-term senator and 2000 Democratic vice presidential candidate. Ned Lamont, a Connecticut cable entrepreneur, stepped forward to do just that when he announced his candidacy March 13th to oust the conservative Democrat. A graduate of Harvard and Yale, Lamont says he's running because he's tired of being represented by a senator who was not willing to stand up to the president on the war and on the rest of his, quote, wrongheaded judicial, fiscal, and environmental policies. Although Lieberman has a huge advantage in name recognition and fundraising for the August 9th Democratic primary, Lamont is hopeful that his grassroots campaign, being organized by experienced progressive activists, will surprise the pundits who see his candidacy as a long shot. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Ned Lamont about his reasons for challenging Senator Lieberman, President Bush's favorite Democrat, and why he believes his campaign is crucial in defining the soul of the Democratic Party.
This is going to be a Democratic seat. And we're a blue state, and I think it's high time that we have a proud Democrat who represent us in the U.S. Senate alongside Chris Dodd. There are a number of issues where, you know, I would challenge Senator Lieberman and think we should, you know, speak more clearly as Democrats in general. You know, it starts off with the war, how we got in this war, how we got in this mess, how our troops are sitting in the middle of a bloody civil war at this point. It says a lot about our fiscal priorities as we spend $300 million a day in Iraq, and we cut back on veterans' benefits, we cut back on preschool and Head Start and student loans and public transportation. And I think we need a senator who stands up for some of the domestic needs we have in this country. And the fact that we're spending the money over there and not over here, I think, says something about our priorities. I think we want a senator who stands up and talks about illegal wire searches in this country, a president who thinks he's above the law. I think they should be held accountable. Wiretaps are a necessary part of our intelligence, but we have a legal method to do that. Nobody's above the law. So I think we have a lot to talk about in this primary.
What are some of your thoughts about an alternative policy on the Iraq war? Any specific plan that you've come up with or endorsed that would change the course of the U.S. policy over there?
Absolutely. I think, you know, as General Casey said, you know, many months ago, our very visible military presence is fueling the insurgency. And I think it's time for a phased withdrawal of our troops. I'd get them immediately out of harm's way, out of the frontline positions. I think it's time for the Iraqis to take responsibility for their own destiny. I agree with some of the comments Chris Dodd recently said, that, look, we'll, they've got a few weeks, a month. They've had plenty of time to put their unity government together. Let's give them a little more period of time, and if they can't do that, they're looking at the abyss, and it's time for our troops to head to the periphery. And I think I agree with that.
Aside from the Iraq War, what are some of the major issues that you feel, as a senator representing Connecticut, you would champion?
I think I would put health care and education at the top of my list. Everywhere you go around our state, you see health care is an issue for individuals who are paying more and more for health insurance and getting less and less care. I'm a small business person. I can tell you the cost of health care is crushing for us. And we lose bids to fly-by-night companies that don't even offer their employees health insurance. It's a cost that's slowly beginning to bankrupt the state government and federal government, and we've got to figure a better way to deliver quality health care to all of our citizens.
Ned Lamont, what's been the degree of support you've gotten from local politicians and nationally for people who may disagree strongly with Joseph Lieberman, acknowledging, of course, he's an incumbent and has a lot of power?
Well, Scott, as we go around the state, all four corners of the state, going to a lot of the town committees, meeting with concerned citizens, talking to folks that haven't seen a U.S. senator for a long time, I might add, and there's a real energy out there. There's a real grassroots support. They think every 18 years or so, let's have a real debate. Today, we've got some big issues that ought to be debated within the Democratic family, you know, starting with the war in Iraq. So I'm getting a lot of support there, and I'm keeping my fingers crossed that we'll be able to get our 15% of the convention and allow us to keep going on to the primary.
The primary is in August. What's your trajectory from here on into August? What kind of activity are you going to be doing to garner support statewide?
I'm going to town committees all across the estate. I'm introducing myself, making sure they know who Ned Lamont is, why I'm running for Senate, why I feel so strongly that we got to take our party back for Democrats. And see if we can make a real change down in Washington, D.C. I just believe that the Bush policies have been so harmful to our state and to our country. You know, from there, we've got thousands of people have signed up at nedlamont.com as volunteers. One of the first things we're asking volunteers to do is help us with a petition drive so we can get 15, 16,000 signatures of registered Democrats. That will allow us to go to the primary, and that will allow us to go into the convention saying, look, we've got grassroots support for this primary. Now I'm looking for your support as well.
Ned Lamont, many progressives I speak with are very upset about where the Democratic Party is lately. They don't see it as having, quote-unquote, backbone in challenging some of the policies of the Bush administration. Certainly, I think Joseph Lieberman is one of President Bush's favorite Democrats, as I've heard it said, and I know you've repeated. What has to happen within the Democratic Party to really take the mantle of, quote-unquote, opposition party back?
I think we should be a constructive opposition party. I think we should talk clearly what we believe, where we think America ought to go, and how we should get there. And sometimes our voices are muddied, and I think Senator Lieberman muddies our voice in the war in Iraq and America's proper role around the world, for example. I think it's time for the Democrats to talk clearly in terms of what we should be doing. And in terms of what our priorities are, I mentioned I think health care, universal, affordable health care has got to be a priority. Also mentioned schools. It's so key that all these kids get on board and believe again. We have to have a public education system in our communities where kids can get a good, proper education, where our schools become community schools. We have preschool, and we also have programs after school to keep them off the streets, to keep them learning so they're inspired. We get these guys active members of our society and our workforce in the years ahead.
That was Ned Lamont, Democratic candidate challenging Connecticut U.S. Senator Joseph Lieberman. Contact the Lamont campaign by calling area code 203-622-7091 or visit their website at www.nedlamont.com.
In another sign of the times, the insurance commissioners of all 50 U.S. states voted unanimously in early March to set up a task force to look at the impact of climate change on the insurance industry and its consumers. The action was prompted by the last two hurricane seasons in the U.S., which resulted in a record $30 billion in insured losses in 2004 and as much as $60 billion in insured losses from Hurricane Katrina alone in 2005. Last year was also the costliest year in weather-related natural disasters on record, according to a recent study by the Munich Re Foundation. Reinsurance companies like Munich Re and Swiss Re underwrite the risk of insurance corporations. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Joel Gordes, an independent energy consultant who's worked since 1994 to determine the impact of climate change on the insurance industry. He talks about the schizophrenic nature of the business and how natural disasters are leading to a re-evaluation of some of the industry's business practices. He begins by explaining that damage due to flooding, which was determined to be the major cause of much of the destruction from Hurricane Katrina, is not covered by most insurance policies.
Many of the losses were due to floods, and unless people have special flood insurance, it is not covered by your private insurers. In Europe, it is. That's why they look at it a lot more seriously over there. Certain things like the wind or driven rain because of the wind, those sorts of things are covered. However, just straight floods are not. So there's huge payouts anyhow, but not because of the flood aspects.
Where do insurance companies fit into the concerns about global warming? They're looking at it, obviously, from a business perspective, right?
Of course, everything is going to be bottom line. But, you know, the insurers are a very, very conservative group. And basically, they are going to rely upon the financial tools that they have always relied upon. And that's basically things ranging from actions such as raising the premiums, raising deductibles, pulling out of certain areas, just plain making the decision not to insure them. Coastal areas where they're prone to great amounts of storm surge and damage certainly are areas that they try to get out of. Now, the problem is sometimes you get a gutsy insurance commissioner. For instance, the insurance commissioner of Florida during the 1992 Hurricane Andrew, when the insurer said, we're not going to insure coastal areas in Florida, said, well, then you're not going to insure anything in Florida. And basically told them, you know, you do the coastal areas and the rest of the state. But they did, in Florida, for instance, have like about 9 insurance companies go bankrupt because of Hurricane Andrew. They have seen the effects of large storms. Now, the secondary question here is the linking of any given storm to global warming is sort of a no-no in scientific circles. You cannot say this storm is linked to it. Now, if you start looking at overall trends and scientists talk in terms of likelihoods, probabilities, statistical types of things, and they say in a global climate changing world, the intensity of the storms will probably be more intense, but they have been perfectly mum in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change as far as the frequency. So we can't outrun the science at this point that's put out by the IPCC.
What's the significance of the concerns of these very conservative business people in raising the profile of climate change?
They don't want to lose money. I think it comes down to their bottom line. And, you know, insurance companies are interesting because the people on the property law side don't often talk with the investment side. There's two parts to almost every insurance company, those who do the assets management and invest money, and those who do the risk aspects of it, of insuring things. And too often they don't talk to each other. So, you know, you might find the asset management people investing in oil and coal and other things, whereas some of the people on the other side of the business may cringe a little bit at that. But it's like, I think they really need to get their act together and align their investments with the policy that is best for themselves and their shareholders.
Joel Gordes, there's a lot of scientists and environmental activists who believe that global warming is happening and are trying to raise the alarm. But even if the insurance industry isn't officially aligned with these other groups, what role does it see for itself in sounding the alarm also and maybe convincing the government to take some steps that maybe scientists and environmentalists haven't been able to convince the government to do?
Sure. It's interesting that since 1995, the United Nations Environment Program has sponsored a financial institutions group on climate change, and the insurers were the first to start issuing statements. And their statements were very strong even then at the reinsurance company level. And so they have made certain statements. I think we need to see a follow-up in action. And there's been some limited actions. Swiss Re has been part of a group to begin investing in sustainable energy sources and such. But we're not seeing a large-scale type of position on that. The other thing they Swiss Re has also talked about is withdrawing or not providing directors and officers insurance to certain firms that do not have carbon mitigation plans. That's a pretty powerful incentive. I haven't seen it invoked yet, but when they do that, I'm pretty sure that that will get the attention of much of the business world.
That was energy consultant Joel Gordes. Contact his group, Environmental Energy Solutions, at area code 860-561-0566 or visit their website at home.earthlink.net/TildaJGordes. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Ruben Abreu, Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
Thanks for listening to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Capron, Steve Diamond, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Joanne Paradise, and Damon Thomas. We welcome your participation too. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. Our theme music is by New Hampshire women's drum group Tabalat, and our mid-show music is Evening Stars by Alice Gomez. You can live stream our show on Saturdays from 2 to 4 if you're not in range of the station by going to www.wirenh.com. Remember that WSCA is growing and hoping for your membership and participation. www.wscafm.org to join and learn more. Tune in next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program. As we leave Women's History Month and enter into April, the month of Earth Day, we'll be exploring connections between women and the environment on our April 1st program. We leave you today with this quote from Margaret Wheatley, author of Leadership and the New Science. Even our seemingly modest actions make a difference. In a web, the potential impact of local actions bears no relationship to their size. When we choose to act locally, we may be wanting to influence the entire system. We never know how our small activities will affect others through the invisible fabric of our connectedness. I have learned that in this exquisitely connected world, it's never a question of critical mass. It's always about critical connections.